Hi, I'm Heather Mulder.
And I'm Janice Greeno, and you're listening to Dementia Untangled, where we explore the topic of dementia through conversations with physicians, experts, and community leaders.
Our discussions focus on innovative ideas, practical strategies, and proven methods to guide caregivers along a supportive path.
Hello, and welcome to Dementia Untangled. Thank you for joining us for this episode of our podcast.
Today, our conversation will be with Hella Brand, a physician assistant at Banner Alzheimer's Institute, and we will be discussing delirium. You know, Janice, delirium is such a tough topic. It's something that can occur on its own, and it's something that can occur in someone who has dementia. And I think why it's so difficult is because a lot of it mimics the symptoms of dementia. I often hear in my work with the hospital system about how difficult it is for nurses and other staff of the hospital who are caring for someone who now has developed a delirium, how they handle that. And I know this is difficult for caregivers to understand and know what to do with as well. So I'm really excited to have Hella here with us to help us have a better understanding of delirium.
It is so difficult, and there's so much confusion around the terms delirium and dementia. Not only do the terms sound alike or similar, they can impact people in similar ways, mentally, physically, emotionally. And today we are seeking ways to just untangle some of those complexities around these terms and around their relationship. And I am also so grateful to have Hella back to share her wisdom and her strategies and guidance from so many years of experience.
Welcome back, Hella.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
In our last conversation, we learned more about your journey and what led you to connect with the dementia community. So now I'm curious to learn, what is your favorite aspect of working with this population, and what keeps you working with people with dementia and their caregivers?
I think my favorite aspect is helping the person with dementia and the caregiver, whoever that might be, or caregivers, have their own aha moments in terms of understanding why they're experiencing what they are, and understanding that they can get through this, that there are tools and resources and support from all of us at Banner Alzheimer's Institute, that there can be joyful moments, and that we can laugh during the visits, and that we can talk about anything. So when a person with dementia leaves and said, "This was good, this was fun," or the family says, "She really looks forward to coming here," I feel like the person with dementia is where they need to be, and that helps the families. And it just makes me feel so validated in why we do what we do.
That's amazing, Hella. And we're so grateful for your expertise and your interactions with families as well. Can we just start at the beginning and set a little bit of a baseline for our listeners? Can you tell us, what is delirium? What does it look like in someone?
So delirium is really a sudden change in mental status or mental ability. So sudden means that we're looking at over hours or maybe a few days. Typically in the hospital, it might be on day two, as opposed to a dementia process that generally comes on slowly over years. And it can affect a person's attention. So they may be even more distractible than they were before. They may not be able to concentrate. They can have worse memory, even functional abilities. So if last week they were able to dress themselves, and this week they can't button, they don't know how to put the clothes on, and they're more confused, then we're looking at that dementia. having changed and delirium coming on board. At the same time, we can also see the opposite, and that can be somebody who is sleeping more, who is very lethargic, or is suddenly very weak and unresponsive, that we're really not sure what's going on. So we can see levels of alertness, changes in sleep patterns, and confusion as well. And it can happen to anybody, regardless of whether they have dementia or not. But the interesting thing is that when we see delirium, a new onset, let's say in the context of coming on after surgery in the hospital for somebody who has had no issues before that cognitively, that can be a predictor for developing dementia in the future. And at the same time, having had delirium in somebody who has some kind of dementia, whether Alzheimer's disease or whatever, is at risk for further episodes of delirium.
When we think about the words delirium and dementia, we've talked about the confusion between the two. And I've heard you say that it's been said that delirium is the reversible dementia. Can you talk about that?
It's called reversible dementia because delirium signals an underlying medical, health, or physical problem. And if we can treat the cause of that, then delirium will resolve over days to weeks and sometimes even months, depending on what was causing it and whether it's very slow in resolving. So that's why we call it a reversible dementia. And the term dementia is just referring to changes in memory and thinking and other areas of brain function like attention or concentration.
A lot of times when I think of delirium, I'm oftentimes thinking of this excited delirium where the person is agitated or they're upset about something, but delirium can be much more subtle where the person does not seem disturbed by these symptoms. Can you talk a little bit about how maybe a caregiver or a family member could discern that a delirium is happening at the same time as a dementia?
So I think, you know, the important thing as family or care partners in the dementia process, you know your person the best. And so you know kind of what they're capable of and where they are in the dementia process. So you have a sense of the baseline. And when we talk about dementia processes, we talk about slow, gradual changes over time. But if we're seeing a sudden change as opposed to a trend and a marked difference from the baseline that we saw, say, last week, that's going to be a sign that there's a probable delirium going on and that we want to seek medical attention.
Hella, what typically causes these deliriums?
The most common causes that we see are dehydration, urinary tract infections, or other infections. Now, you know, other causes are going to be more serious illness. So let's say somebody has an underlying congestive heart failure, and all of a sudden the heart is struggling more to work. We can see delirium. So a worsening of a chronic health condition. Medications can cause it. So especially when we look at pain management, say post-operatively, where it might be given an opioid or something and never been exposed to that, we can see medications causing it. But the most common, as I said, are going to be the urinary tract infection and dehydration.
I feel like I hear a lot about delirium onsetting while someone is in the hospital. Do you know why that happens?
Yeah, it's the response to numbers of triggers. So we know that anesthesia can cause delirium. We know that the surgery itself can cause delirium. A hospital environment, we've gotten much better at making it a quieter environment, but having had multiple hospitalizations myself over the last year, it isn't always the case. And so sleep is disrupted. And we all know what sleep deprivation can do to our own abilities to concentrate and to be as clear in our thinking and our function in the course of a day. And then managing the medications and whatever medical issues we have, they all come together to contribute to delirium. And in those with dementia who rely so heavily on a predictable environment and a predictable routine, and now have a complete disruption of their routine and environment, it can be even more confusing for them and contributing to the delirium.
It sounds to me like it's even more complex than I had imagined. I'm just wondering, how do you treat these various things that can be causing, like hydration, for instance?
Yeah, so that's probably one of the questions that I get asked most during visits is, you know, mom or dad or my husband or wife, just it's really hard to get her to drink. So we still have a generation that didn't grow up with the idea of drinking regularly during the day, of hydrating and water like we have our newer generations. And we have to remember that that may not even be in their memory banks to get water. So we have to provide for them. And I think in terms of how do we prevent dehydration, and make sure that they are getting hydrated, it's to look at individual tastes. Will she drink better if it's iced or if it's room temperature? Is it seltzer with a little flavor, or is it flat water? We can also use foods, because we know lots of times taste preferences move a little bit more towards sweets. So using things like applesauce and Jell-O, watermelon, these are all things that have high water content, popsicles. So we can provide hydration that way. And it's important that when we give fluids to someone, we not try and convince them you need to drink, because then we sound either parental or somewhat like a dictator in a way. So we say, let's make sure that you've got plenty to drink today. I don't know about you, but I am thirsty. It's so hot in here, right? So different ways to bring it about that way. Or when we know they are a little bit more alert and can sit up, we might bring them fluids. And I got us each a drink. So we sound collaborative. And we also have to remember, particularly older women will stop drinking if they've had frequent urinary tract infections as an attempt to not have to go to the bathroom and not have the infections. But in fact, that dries the tissue out in the vaginal and urinary areas and puts them more at risk for dehydration. So that might be just a reminder, the doctor wants us to make sure that we get the liquids in so that you don't get other infections.
These are all really helpful tips for dealing with dehydration or delirium caused by dehydration. With these other causes, is it really just managing that underlying cause, antibiotics for the urinary tract infection or what have you?
So it's working closely with your primary care physician. You really want a doctor who understands that if you call and say, my person has had a significant change in mental status, and obviously you're not concerned that there's been a stroke, they're able to still talk, or you're not seeing obvious signs of paralysis, so the doctor might be the appropriate way, but a doctor who will say, come on in, and recognize the need to probably do some labs to see if there's an infection, do a basic physical exam to see if anything can be identified. And again, when you're talking to the doctor at the visit, you want to be able to tell them any symptoms that you might have seen. For instance, if it's a urinary tract infection, is the person going to the bathroom more often? Have you noticed a stronger odor to the urine? Is it darker in color? Is there urgency? Do they complain of pain or burning, right? Do some of the detective work that can help the doctor, because the person with dementia may not be able to describe what it is they're feeling. And that's why we often call delirium the voice of dementia. So unlike people who don't have memory or thinking problems, they can go and talk to a doctor. Well, this is what I've noticed, and it started on this date. The person can't with dementia, and their body tends to act out whatever is happening, much like young children, right? So infants can't tell us when they have an ear infection, but they may be more irritable. They may be more distressed, show us pain, be pulling at their ear, for instance. So delirium does the same for the person with dementia.
Hella, that is so fascinating. Delirium, the voice of dementia, and how important it is to, as a caregiver, to have that detective hat on. And then when you have discovered something, to share that with your doctor.
And other things, you know, have they fallen? Have they had more constipation? Any other changes that you can identify that may help the doctor steer the physical exam, the tests ordered one way, or even steer you to the emergency room if doctor thinks that's more appropriate. And if you can't get in to see your doctor on that day, that's where I think urgent cares come in really handy, because they can really screen for these basic infections and not be in that chaotic environment that is an emergency room.
Is there any way that delirium can be avoided? Are there any prevention strategies?
Well, I think, certainly like we talked with preventing dehydration, recognizing if somebody is prone to urinary tract infections, what prophylaxis can we do? Sometimes it's an antibiotic if they've had a significant number of infections within a year, keeping them hydrated, looking at things like cranberry pills or juice, all of the things that we hear about for urinary tract infections, reducing the risk of falls that can introduce fractures or head trauma. I think making sure that you get routine medical care for your person so that any potential illnesses are recognized in advance, or changes in ongoing illnesses, diabetes, hypertension, for instance, are addressed so that we can avoid hospitalization and delirium. And then when we do have to have delirium, when we do have to have hospitalization, that careful conversation with the doctors. Is this something that is emergent? Is this something that can wait? What's the expected outcome? And how do we modify it? Understanding that there is dementia, and also having the careful discussion, because remember, at a time that a person can no longer express what they're feeling, you as a caregiver are acting as an advocate on behalf of your person, and you are representing them as the medical power of attorney. So you are making decisions based on their best interest and based on what you know of their expressed wishes over the year, how they would want to be treated in certain conditions. So what you decide earlier on in a dementia process might be way different than what you decide together with the doctor in the later process. So an extreme example, for instance, if somebody is really difficult to hydrate and is anemic and it's suspected that they have maybe a stomach bleed and the doctor wants to do colonoscopy and they're requiring help with all of their personal care, so they're in the later stages, is it reasonable to expect that you can put them through the full prep that takes an awful lot of liquid, 64 ounces in a short period of time, then have them have an anesthetic for a process? And if, a potential colon cancer or something is recognized, are we going to put them through extensive treatment for that? So that's where that advocacy and knowing your person and what their wishes are is so important in conveying that to the doctor and working together as a team for the best possible plan.
That is such an outstanding reminder, and we have to have those careful discussions. Mm-hmm. And I like how you're saying that we need to, in advance, know what those goals of care are for that person.
Exactly. And that's why we advocate so strongly to get those powers of attorney done, the medical, the mental health, the financial, early on. And I would say, even before dementia sets in, this is something we should be looking at as a society and as we age, so that family, spouses all know what our wishes would be, so that we are honored to the end that way at a time that we're vulnerable and can't express for ourselves what we would want.
Hala, I know when we talk about different strategies for quality of life and for providing care for a person with dementia, we often focus on these non-pharmacological mm-hmm. interventions. Does the same hold true for a delirium?
Yes, we still want to try and use non-pharmacological strategies with the hopes of avoiding medications that can compound the situation. But in certain situations where safety is a concern or treatment is not optimal, for instance, as you said earlier, the person who is excitedly delirious, that might be the one who is pulling out IVs, up and yelling, trying to get out of the bed where there's risk for falls, that sort of a thing, we might have to resort to medication. But I think the rest of it is to have that calm environment, to have the caregiver present, have everyone speak in calm, reassuring ways. Staff should always introduce themselves and explain what's going to happen in very simple terms, not just come in, grab an arm and do an IV, as I saw happen with my uncle, for instance, and then they're upset because they experience agitation. They should be encouraged to rest on and off during the day, but also be encouraged to get out of bed as soon as possible and start normalizing their routine, having familiar objects around them or comforting objects around them helps. Playing music rather than the television that can feed into confusion. I think these are all things that can make a difference when somebody is delirious.
When you talk about these non-pharmacological approaches, I've heard you mention sleep and the importance of sleep. And how can you encourage that rest for someone, whether they're in the hospital or at home?
Yeah, so I think it's about how we create the atmosphere. So in the morning, we want them to wake up. So we want those blinds to be open. The later it gets in the day, at night, we want the blinds down and all signals saying, please consider we're getting ready for bed. But during the day, after somebody has been actively engaged in a task, an activity, and whatever, then we want a quieter, restful period. It may not be about sleeping at that time, but it may be about making them comfortable in a recliner, maybe pleasant music playing that might be sleep conducive, and maybe just sitting with them and quietly reminiscing with them, holding their hand, stroking. These are all things that can help people kind of relax and settle into a quiet time or a restful time, and creating those throughout the day.
And you mentioned, you know, the importance of engaging in activity throughout the day. Mm-hmm. I think about these sort of alternative therapies like music therapy, pet therapy, art therapy.
Yes.
Are those helpful for the treatment or management of delirium as well?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, think about how music can affect your spirit, how music can affect your energy level, your concentration, right? So music therapy can help me settle if I am anxious or nervous, for instance. Music that is a little bit more lively can be helpful in making me wake up a little bit more. Certainly pets are a huge source of comfort, you know, whether it's a pet therapist in the context of a hospital visit or your own pet, having them there to just snuggle with and pet them can be very reassuring and calming, and help the person tremendously. Saying prayers together and that quiet reminiscing can all make a difference. If somebody is, for instance, very spiritually oriented and faith is important to them, singing the music of the church and doing the prayers, all of those can make a difference.
And then I also wonder, Hella, could you talk to the importance of someone who maybe wears glasses or wears hearing aids or needs some other support along those lines, the importance of keeping that around the person, keeping that on the person while they're experiencing a delirium?
Yes, that's a very important point, Heather. If someone normally needs glasses to see what's going on in their environment, hearing aids to hear better, these are all things that are going to help them kind of have a sense of where they are, be able to hear what people are saying to them, so it can help them focus their attention a little bit better. If they need any adaptive equipment to help them walk, that would also be important, because that means a difference in getting up and reestablishing their routine and not losing a lot of strength in the course of whatever illness they're having.
Wow, Hella, this has been a really enlightening conversation, and I think really helpful with the different strategies and approaches that you offer. I wonder, before we close today, could you give us your final thought when it comes to delirium?
I think probably just remember that delirium has a more sudden onset. It mimics dementia, and when we talk dementia, remember that just is symptoms. It's memory and changes in thinking, it's attention, it's level of alertness, agitation, sleep pattern changes. People can be kind of hyper or hypo, those who are excessively sleeping and maybe not rousable or weaker all of a sudden. And remember that delirium comes on over hours to days, and it always represents some kind of an underlying illness, infection, something that needs to be addressed. And when we do, we see an improvement in the symptoms, as opposed to dementia that is ongoing and caused by physical changes in the brain.
Today, our conversation has been with Hella Brand, a physician assistant with Banner Alzheimer's Institute. We so appreciate you helping us untangle delirium and dementia.
It was great to be with everyone.
Yes, thank you so much, Hella. We really appreciate you untangling this complicated topic of delirium, and you did such a beautiful job. It was great to have you back on the podcast. And thank you, Heather, for another great conversation. And thank you to our listeners for joining us. If you haven't already, please subscribe and share this podcast. I'm looking forward to our next conversation on Dementia Untangled. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Dementia Untangled. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dementia Untangled is hosted by Heather Mulder and Janice Greeno, produced and edited by Amber Ayers, and is brought to you by Banner Alzheimer's Institute and Banner Sun Health Research Institute. We are supported by generous donations to the Banner Alzheimer's Foundation.
Please visit our website at banneralz.org and follow us on Facebook to learn about upcoming events. If you have questions or comments, please email us at dementiauntangled@bannerhealth.com.